place it comfortably. So, in the Mahayana world, in the Zen world, tonight is Realization Eve, or Buddha Eve, you could say. The final day before the Buddha broke through and realized Nirvana. Resolving his question, why is there suffering? Once and for all. And that realization reverberates through space and time. Our guides here are Shakyamuni, focused in meditation and yet not knowing what lay ahead for him, not knowing what the outcome would be. The Bodhi tree in the forest by the Nerinjara River, where Shakyamuni sat in meditation. And on the altar, the Buddha is now sitting under a piece of Ficus rubiginosa, which is the Australian, one of the Australian variants of the Ficus family. The Buddha sat under Ficus religiosa, which has a heart-shaped leaf. The Australian figs are quite strappy and quite different shaped leaves, but nevertheless, Ficus. So there he sits under a Ficus. And also our guide is Sujata, who I mentioned yesterday, who I feel really is a very important bodhisattva in our tradition, in the Buddhist tradition. She and her little brother, were tending the herd, taking the herds through to the grasses. And there was this emaciated, almost comatose man. And she just went and got him some rice and milk and fed him. He'd taken a vow not to eat, along with his other ascetic friends. But on eating and on sort of regaining a certain amount of energy, he realized that unless he ate, he probably wouldn't be able to keep practicing. And there was an inkling of a middle way here. In 1988, Tony and I were on a pilgrimage to all the key Buddhist sites in India and Nepal with Thich Nhat Hanh and a whole bunch of people from Plum Village and people from all over the world. There were 28 of us. And we travelled to the Nerinjara River where the Buddha was sitting under the fig tree. And he talked about the little girl and her brother. And then we made a journey to a small village nearby where the people of the village could well have been the descendants of Sujata, and where we had a most extraordinary morning tea supplied by us and handed out very small gifts to the children who didn't seem to know the story of the Buddha. They didn't really understand quite what we were all doing there. They mobbed us and went quite mad. And anyway, that was our giving back to the little children of this area who had given so freely to the Buddha. And I'll never forget that. And there's some rice pudding up on the altar in a little dish, which is that meal that actually kept him going. And she fed him. She started to bring food every day after that. And then there's the morning star. It's not yet... it's moving inexorably towards the dawn sky, but it's not quite there yet, so I'm getting ahead of myself. Just before he died, the Buddha said to Ananda, "The two meals I treasure the most in my life were the one I ate just before attaining the way and my last meal before passing into Nirvana. into Mahaparinirvana. And this last meal was given by a devoted layperson. Some people say it was a contaminated meal. The poor layperson who gave the meal had no idea of that, but that after that meal the Buddha was quite ill and didn't eat again until he died. We went to the place where the Buddha died, and that's a small, there's a small amount of reverence for that place, but you know, Buddhism in India is pretty well a relic, except probably except where there's a descendant of that ficus religiosa, and where people come from all over, and many, many pilgrims. There are a few sites like that, but as a living practice, Buddhism is pretty scant on the ground, except for some incredible energetic people who have taken up Buddhism and become incredibly energetic and fantastically engaged. And these are people who were in the untouchable sort of non-caste situation and who have become Buddhists inspired by the first Attorney General of India, who had also moved from the untouchable to Buddhism. Wonderful. So there is Buddhism, and it's fresh and new, but very, very small. Anyway, so he said, the Buddha said also to Ananda just before he died, if you want to express your respect and gratitude to the Tathagata, there is only one way, and that is by living the teaching. The Buddha lived the teaching and inspired many to do the same, and so it goes. An unbroken chain of men and women practicing in India, Afghanistan, China, Vietnam, Indonesia, Japan, Australia, and how many generations to come may gain the path here, no one knows. One of the links in the chain, back in the 9th century in China, is Xiang Yin, and I'm going to give an account of his awakening. He was a disciple of Pai Cheng, and after his teacher's death, he went to see Kui Shan, who was also a senior student of Pai Cheng. Kui Shan said, I am told that you have been under my late master Pai Cheng, and also that you have remarkable intelligence. But the understanding of Zen through this medium necessarily ends in intellectual and analytical comprehension, which is of not much use. Yet you may have had an insight into the truth of Zen. Let me have your view on the reason of birth and death, that is, on your own being before your parents gave birth to you, before your parents were even born. There's another story just slightly shifts this question to become, what is your original face? And this story, I'll just briefly tell this story. After receiving secret transmission, Hui Nang is pursued by an irate head monk who's sure that Hui Nang's transmission is fraudulent. And he wants that robe back and he wants that bowl back. These are the two symbols, as far as he was concerned, of transmission. And he's running after Hui Nang, trying to grab them back. So Hui Nang lays him down on a rock for the head monk to take. But when the head monk tries to lift the bowl up and lift the robe up, they're immovable, completely immovable, like a mountain. And Hui Nang says at this point, don't think good, don't think evil. At this very moment, what is the original face of Ming, the head monk? And at this very moment, the head monk had great satori, and sweat ran from his entire body, and in tears he made his bow. He was clearly ripe for this encounter, for this moment to break through. So much zeal, so much passion, so much energy. And then to be stopped. But Xian Yang didn't know what to say to Kuai Shan. He couldn't answer his question. Even though he was a highly intelligent and highly learned monk. So he retired to his room and searched assiduously among the notes he'd taken of Pai Chang's Taisho. And though he searched and searched, he failed to come across a suitable passage for presentation as his own view as to what is the reason of birth and death before my parents were born. And this is somewhat familiar, this experience. Many of us may have memories of going back to our notes after being rung out of Dokusan by a teacher. For me, it was Aiken Roshi, and searching in vain for a line, a phrase that would resonate with the koan, and then seeing what I was doing and letting that search go, remembering the Buddha's way, trusting the way. Anyway, Xian Yang returned to Kuai Shan and begged for instruction. You can imagine his sense of inadequacy, of spiritual poverty, that he would beg for the Dharma like this. But Kuai Shan said, "I really have nothing to tell you, and if I tried to do so, you might make me an object of ridicule later on. Besides, whatever I say is my own and will never be yours." Xian Yang was disappointed and considered Kuai Shan unkind. That too is a familiar experience. The bell in Dokusan arouses many uncomfortable feelings. But who is disappointed and who is unkind? After this meeting, Xian Yang decided that his accumulated notes were useless, and he decided to burn everything. Clearly, none of it contributed anything to his spiritual search. Then he decided he'd leave the monastery and spend his life in solitude and simplicity, in accordance with the monastic rules. He reasoned, what's the use of studying Buddhism when it's so difficult to comprehend and too subtle to be transmitted by another? I'll be a plain homeless monk, troubled with no desire to master things too deep for thought. So this is a radical move for a highly respected scholar. But note that he says, I'll be a plain homeless monk, troubled with no desire to master things. So he's not going away to get a hold of something. He's going away to live in simplicity and humility. Then he heard that the tomb of Nanyang, the national master, was being neglected. So he left Kuai Shan's temple and went to the tomb, which was a way away, and he built a little hut for himself near the tomb. I find this deeply moving. He's become a solitary caretaker. Only the leaves and ants aware of his daily samu. And all the while, he's holding Kuai Shan's question, we can assume, moment by moment. Sweep, sweep, weed, weed. Let me have your view on the reason of birth and death, on your being born before your parents gave birth to you, before your parents were even born. Sweep, sweep, weed, weed. What is my original face? Many months, perhaps years, went by. One day, when sweeping the ground, a little pebble, or some accounts mention a piece of tile, flew up from his broom and struck a bamboo. And with that sound, everything fell away. Kuai Shan's question, what is your view on the reason of birth and death, on your own being before your parents gave birth to you, even before your parents were born, became completely transparent. His joy was boundless. He hurried to his little hut, bathed, offered incense, and bowed in the direction of Kuai Shan's temple in deep gratitude for Kuai Shan's great kindness in refusing him instruction that day, his generosity in withholding explanations. He knew this wouldn't have happened if Kuai Shan had been unkind enough to explain things for him. Then he packed up and returned to Kuai Shan. He showed him the poem he'd composed about his understanding. One stroke, One tok has made me forget all my previous knowledge. No artificial discipline is needed at all. In every moment I uphold the ancient way and never fall into the rut of mere quietism. No traces are left wherever I walk, and my senses are not fettered by rules of conduct. Everywhere, all those who have attained to the truth declare this to be the highest order. There's another couple of incidents in relation to this where one of the monks in Kuaishan's temple expressed dissatisfaction with the insight expressed in this poem. He sort of sneered at it, like that. So he wrote, Xian Ying wrote a second poem, and this monk again went, you think that's insight? And so then he wrote a third poem, and finally that monk accepted that, yeah, okay, that's all right. I didn't think I'd go through those poems with you today, but that's what happened. So one stroke and his original face was revealed. When Zazen is the ground, all other activity is practice, and practice is what makes Satori possible. Kensho, seeing into your nature, having it become vividly apparent. Dogen Zenji said, cease practice based on intellectual understanding, pursuing words and following after speech. Learn the backward step that turns your light inward to illuminate within. Body and mind of themselves will drop away, and your original face will be manifest. And Dogen goes on to say, ponder the fact that Xian Yin realized the way by the sound of bamboo, that another clarified the mind at the sight of peach blossoms. How could it be possible to differentiate smart bamboo trees from dull ones, or deluded ones from enlightened ones? How could there be shallow or deep, wise or stupid, among flowers? The flowers bloom every year. Nevertheless, not everyone attains enlightenment by viewing them. Stones often strike bamboo. Still not everyone who hears the sound clarifies the way. Only through the virtue of long study and continuous practice with the assistance of diligent effort in the way does one realize the way or clarify the mind. This does not occur because the sound of bamboo was especially wonderful, nor because the colour of peach blossoms was particularly profound. Although the sound of bamboo is marvellous, it does not sound of itself. It cries out with the help of a piece of tile. Although the colour of peach blossoms is beautiful in themselves, they open with the help of the spring breeze. The condition of practicing the way is also like this. Without Kuaishan's words to Xian Ying, that tok would have fallen on deaf ears. Really, I have nothing to teach you, he said. And right there is a space for students to inhabit, to enter and penetrate all on their own. Whatever understanding I have is my own and will never be yours, Kuaishan said. There is no thing to be handed on, to be anxious about, or to attain. We sit with Dogen's encouraging words. Only through the virtue of long study and continuous practice with the assistance of diligent effort in the way does one realize the way or clarify the mind. Each moment of Zazen is equally wholeness of practice, equally wholeness of realization. The Zazen of even one person at one moment imperceptibly accords with all things and fully resonates through all time. Thus, in the past, future, and present of the limitless universe, this Zazen carries on the Buddha's teaching endlessly. Pai Chang said, after realization, one is still the same as one was before. One is simply free from unreality and delusion. The ordinary person's mind is the same as the sage's, because original mind is perfect and complete in itself. After you have had this recognition, please don't lose it. Do not neglect your practice, in other words. So, right here in Nanyang Cemetery, sweeping and weeding, right here under the Bodhi tree by the Nerinjara River, meditating, right here in this city dojo, focusing on the koan, being with each breath, your original face has nowhere to hide. Your original mind is perfect and complete. right now. And thank you for your diligent practice, and keep it up.